Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, this is such an honor today. I am talking to somebody who, well, on the ladder to success of Joy on Paper, I have come a long way. It's going to be the 7th anniversary soon. And I am so thrilled because sometimes you just dream about talking to somebody important. And of course, I talk to so many important people. But Cyrus Friedheim is perhaps, well, he's one of my favorite people because I have read this book that he wrote. And I think it is so impressive. And I just want to thank him so much for being on Joy on Paper today because, you know, success. His book is called Commit and Deliver on the Front Lines of Management Consulting. But before I start talking to him, I want to say good morning, Mr. Friedheim.
Good morning.
Okay, I have a song I want to play for you, okay? Joy on Paper, Mr. Friedheim.
Thank you very much. What an honor.
Well, you know, you represent something very important to me. First, a connection to my past and a connection to something very special. Since I started Joy on Paper, I have discovered these magical golden threads that connect me to so many of the authors that I talk to. And, of course, you are a major one because I actually worked for Booz Allen and Hamilton for a short period of time, and I loved it. It was my first corporate job, and because of that, it's carried me through for all these years, and now talking to you puts me within, you know, they talk about 6 degrees of separation. Well, I am now, like, I think within 1 degree of separation from somebody I have wanted to speak to ever since I started this program, and that is Henry Kissinger. So we're going to talk a little bit about the connections that we have, but it is just an honor to welcome you to the show because Commit and Deliver, I think, is such an important book. For me, it is going to be like my 2021 pick of one of the most important books of the year.
Wow.
Well, you know, for somebody like you, we need at this time and in this horrible era that we're going through, people who are ready to commit and deliver. And so this book, I just hit the right spot, I think, and I hope that people will understand that it's about so much more than just your work, just the great success that you've had of being on, I think, 15 boards, right? You've been on 15 major boards?
15 corporate and then another 20 or so not-for-profit.
Okay. Well, I played the victory song because it reminded me of your mother, and I want you to tell us a little bit about her because when I read this book, one of the things I kept thinking about as a homeschool mother that I would love to share with homeschool mothers this book because I think it will inspire them because your mother was pretty inspiring.
Well, thank you. And she was certainly a key in my life. We all look to our moms, particularly when things go wrong, say, Mom, where's Mom? You know, you see this great big guy who's just gotten beat up or something like that, maybe even a boxing match. And what does he first say? Mom. Well, my mom didn't go to college, but she had no question in her mind, nor did my dad. Nor they had no question that I was going to college, and all the other of the five of us would go to college. So they, between the two of them, had like a one semester of college. They wound up with five kids, four of whom had advanced degrees, and all of whom had wonderful careers. So she is a total inspiration. I think the thing you were referring to is when time came for each of us to decide on where we might go to college. Remember, weather wasn't an issue. Where, a little bit of an issue. But she used to play, the one thing she could remember to play, because she played piano as a kid, is the Notre Dame Victory March. So every time we came down for breakfast during the decision period, she was on the piano playing the Notre Dame Victory March.
Well, that is just the kind of thing that mothers should do. They have to inspire their children. And as you said, she didn't go to college, but she knew the importance of education. And so you really, you were blessed to have a mother and father like that. And while what you have done over the years is amazing. I don't know where to start. I do want to mention this story that you write in the beginning, the story about Ronald Reagan. Why don't you remind people of this? Because this is really a great example.
Well, for those of us who were around at the time, remember this is back in 1980, when Ronald Reagan became president, shortly after that, the PATCO, the Union of air controllers in the United States for our commercial airlines, went on strike. And I can't remember the reason for it, but it was money and conditions and the normal things. But because of the way the laws are structured, there are certain categories of people, particularly in government service, that can't go on strike, notably like the military. Well, the air controller system is the same. They cannot go on strike. So they did anyway. He told them they couldn't. It was illegal. And they declared it like on Friday or something. And he said in 48 hours, if anybody who is still on strike will be fired. And in the meantime, what he did is he figured out how to run the airline system without the controllers, those controllers. And so when the time came, and for those of us who were alive at the time, we remember how many times during that 48-hour period he got on television or radio and said, go back to work. You will be fired if you don't. And so when the time came, he immediately, when the clock struck 48 hours from his first announcement, he got on the TV and the radio and said, all 11,000 who are still on strike are fired. Fired, but they were banned from ever working again in the United States as air controllers. And that was a classic example of commit and deliver.
Wow, it was, because nobody believed that he would do it. I'm sure
nobody believed it.
What the talking heads went back, back then, they didn't have all the cable. But can you imagine the talking heads today would explode right on television if somebody did that?
Right.
So it is really an amazing story. And let's start with your story, how you made it. Again, you went to college, you studied something that you discovered wasn't exactly what you wanted to become. But you use that and everything else that you did, and how did you just get yourself in line for what you eventually became, which was a major leader in the consulting business? And I want to then talk about the consulting business, because right now it's got a little bit of a bad reputation. But what you did, the things that you did to save companies, to build companies, is fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to pick up the story at any one point in time. I think the let me try this on you. There's an underlying theme in the whole book, and that is that your most important project is you. And when we look at life, whether it be your personal life or your professional life, your career, and by career I don't mean just work career. You know, there's being a full-time mom, as far as I'm concerned, is a career. Being a part-time bricklayer is a career thing. So whatever you do with your life other than the personal life. So I divide the world into my thinking about life in those two buckets. And one of the keys that I've observed, in much of this, by the way, is in retrospect, I wasn't so smart that I knew all this stuff when I was 18, and which is one of the reasons that I've done the book, so that I can help people when they are 18 to see the world in a different way. Every person is equal in the eyes of the Creator at birth. It's actually a brilliant design. We are all the same, and yet we're all unique. We're all unique physically. You know, we got two arms, two legs, five toes on each foot. You know, some have six, but fundamentally, we're all the same. And we're all the same inside as well. And we have common instincts like personal survival and survival of the species and love and happiness and freedom. And at birth, on the other hand, we're the same in all those things. On the other hand, we are, every single one of us is unique. 8 billion people, and we're all unique. We have a unique DNA. We have unique appearance. Can you imagine, you can recognize there's no two people on Earth that look exactly the same. And we all come from different circumstances. So during life, everything, after birth, everything is unique. You don't have a choice on birth. You're born where you're born, to the people who are your parents and the place, and all the rest of that stuff is predetermined. But during life, everyone has opportunities and challenges and talents. It's what you do with those that matters. And the book suggests a way to think about that issue. How am I being anybody, going to navigate my set of opportunities, challenges, and talents, given where I come from, which is fixed? You know, if I am if I'm from Africa, I'm probably going to be black, and I'm going to be, well, by, you know, the vast numbers of them, over half are really poor, and if I come from New York, I'm wholly different in circumstance. But those are my circumstances, and I could do one of two things with those. I can either say, gee, I was given too tough a hand, the life is against me, I'm a victim, and come help me. Or you can say, hey, look, this is what I got. I'm a human being. I'm certainly better off than the horse or the dog, and no matter what it is. And I can always think about other people who have really been through tough, tough times and survived. So how I handle those things is really what the book is all about. And so what I did is I got jobs as a kid, learned what I didn't like as well as I liked. I tried to sort through what I was good at, what I was not, what I was interested in, and what I was not, to set up the question, what am I going to do for the rest of my life? Which was a question I dealt with throughout my life. And the point you're making is, when I went to Notre Dame, I chose chemical engineering. Well, I knew within a few weeks, certainly the first semester, that that's not where I wanted to spend my life. I hated lab. I hated a lot about it. I loved the analytics, the chemistry, the physics. All that stuff was great. But getting in there and titrating two products to get a little stuff at the bottom or, that was terrible. So despite that fact, I didn't change. And I should have. And so the point I'm making in the book with my career is I made a big mistake. I didn't switch. And if I had a mentor or if I knew how to think about it, if I knew what other opportunities were, I'm certain I would have shifted. I didn't. And the book goes through a lot of transitions like that. And it's based on the little prelude that I laid out that, you know, we all have our talents, our opportunities, and our challenges. And how we deal with them is the key. And one of the most important things is to know that you have to address them.
Exactly. Well, you know, one of the things that I will say this, I did something, well, really great, because I did one thing better before you did. I can say to people, I talked to Cyrus Friedheim, and I did one thing before he did, and I got my paper out when I was 7 years old, and you started yours when you were 8 years old.
You were an early bird.
And I was a girl, you have to remember. I was the first girl in my town to have a paper out.
I believe that.
So I was really ahead of the times. And I remember I went and I said, the newspapers would come up from Chicago, and they would, lived in the Upper Peninsula, they'd come up from Chicago, and of course they had boys who were doing the paper routes, and I went to the railway station where the dispatcher was, and I said, I want to deliver papers, and he says, you're a girl. And I said, I'm better than they are. And I was. I was the best paper girl that they ever had because, first of all, and I got subscriptions that they never had because I was a girl. And one of the things in our little town, you know, very much like a English village, we had three taverns. And all I had to do was go there, and I would get people signing up for newspapers. It was wonderful. And all the neighbors, I wasn't shy. See, the paper boys delivered the papers. I got subscriptions.
Ah, that was way beyond my skill.
See, I realized that. And that's why I so impressed, the dispatcher at the train station. But this is one of the things. So I upped you on one thing, but of course you have you blew it away on everything else because your career has been stellar. When you shoot for the stars, you really did. Because I of course love Booz Allen. If I had known about this book before I booked you, I would have booked the whole hour, because I could spend an hour just talking about how much I love Booz Allen. Let's talk a little bit about that, and then I have, since you are the major, somebody in the business who really understands management consultant, I have a little company that I want to talk to you about. So go ahead and tell us a little bit about Booz Allen and how you managed to do so many things in 35 years.
Well, I wound up there because I had a good mentor. As a matter of fact, there were two different ones. And this is a point I really wanted to make in the book, is that none of us can navigate our lives on our own. And mentors are extraordinarily valuable. I didn't know that, as I was growing up. And until really I got well into my professional career did I realize how much impact certain people have had on my life. And so one of the major recommendations here is get mentors, and Booz Allen I certainly did. As a matter of fact, I kind of had a subheading or a subtitle for the book, and that's the book is a mentor in a memoir form. So it's not really a biography or autobiography. It's more of a mentor of people going through their lives. But because of a couple of mentors and a friend, I got a call. I was about to leave Ford Motor Company, and I got a call and from a friend of mine, a classmate in at Carnegie Mellon, who went directly to Booz Allen out of school. I went to Ford Motor Company, and he called me, and he hit it right at the perfect point where I had pretty much decided that I was going to leave Ford. I wasn't going to make the same mistake that I made with chemical engineering a second time. I realized that Ford was a great stopping point for me, but it wasn't the end point. So I talked to him, and I just loved the idea of working for lots of different companies on lots of different projects and being what I call in the room. In the room means, you know, where the decisions are made, and that's typically in the CEO's office. So I launched it, and I jumped at it, and it was better than I could have imagined at the end of the first year. I loved it. My wife and I talked about it before I accepted, and, you know, I realized that there was travel involved, and I didn't know how we'd handle that because I had never been away a single night after we got married. And so, and this, you know, the first year, there was a fair amount of it. So that was a tough part, but the rest was so good and so exhilarating that I continued on. I used to tell people, management consultant isn't for everybody, but what you're faced with is you're given a project, and it's typically by the top decision maker, although sometimes it was somebody down the line. But it was somebody who knows the company much better than you do, who knows the problem much better than you do, but who thinks it's important enough for the company to hire an outsider to help, and you're given 3 months to solve this problem and convince him to act in something that he, in effect, paid you to look at. And for the right person, that's the most exhilarating thing imaginable. For the wrong person, it's sheer hell.
Well,
so that's what management consulting was to me.
And it is a fun life, I can tell you. In so many ways, when you have great success, when you manage to help companies survive, as you did, and many of them thrive because of your work, it is a very rewarding job. And you know, I having seen it, I was, you know, as I mentioned it to you, I was just a small cog in Booz Allen, but I watched as the consultants came up with ideas and came up with solutions, and they were so excited, and it was an exciting place to work and a wonderful work atmosphere. So, you know, I'm just very, very proud of what I little bit that I did. And so when I read your stories, I think they're fascinating. And as I said, I don't have a lot of time with you today, although I would like perhaps you could come back again and we could have more time. I do want to ask this. You really insisted that Iacocca call you. This is when you were with Ford,
right? I was with Booz Allen.
You were with Booz Allen. So did you? I mean, you insisted he make a personal call to you.
Yes.
Wow.
Here's what happened. Well, he didn't have to make the call. What he had to do is see me, you know, and so. But he had to call me to set up the meeting. I wasn't going to call him.
Oh, wow.
And the reason is a little complex, but I think you'll understand it. He historically, and I knew this, and we had talked about it on occasions when I was working with him during the first few weeks of this project. He didn't like management consultants. His view was that a management consultant, person that calls on and used a management consultant, really couldn't do his job. And so he was never going to get caught in that trap. So during the first few weeks of the assignment, which was to answer a question for the Secretary of the Treasury, he said the Chrysler has come to the government and asking for basically a bailout. And so the Secretary of Treasury said to us, look, I don't want to bail them out if they can't survive. So you tell me whether their plan is viable. Well, we went in and found out their plan, they didn't have a plan. They had not a plan to survive what was happening to them. They had a product plan and a budget and a personnel plan and all those other kind of things, but nothing that put everything together and said, all right, our sales are crashing, our profits are terrible, we're running out of cash, and what do we do?
And you came out with an idea. And this is what consultants do. And people have to read this book and really find out the story behind this solution that you came out with. And with so many of the other great successes you had, because Commit and Deliver, I think, is a very important book. And I wouldn't have booked anyone else, but I do have somebody coming up. So I'm going to have to cut it short soon. But I want to ask you... I'm coming to you as a client. I have a company, and you are the management consultant to go to when you have a really big problem. And I have a big problem. I have a company, and I'm manufacturing airplanes, and I love my airplanes. They're really great airplanes. I came out with a new design. I'll call it the Patsy Corporation, because my husband was a pilot in the Israeli Air Force, so he gave me lots of good ideas. I designed a plane. I started it. The company's going, we're turning out the from the factory. The planes are coming out. They're coming out of the hangar. Now, as the planes, they get to the, many of them get to the runway, and when they get to the runway, only 26% of them take off. The rest can't do anything. They're on the runway, on the taxiway. Okay, so 26% can take off. Now, obviously, I'm in trouble, right?
Right.
I'm in big trouble. So I come to you and I say, okay, what's the solution here? Help me. I've tried everything with my people. I told them, you have to produce more. You have to make the planes so they run. I mean, check, quality control. And I do everything for them. I give them raises. I give them bonuses if they get a plane off the ground. I give them, because I lived in England a long time, I give them 4 o'clock high tea, even with cucumber sandwiches. And still, nothing happens, and only 26% get off the ground. What should I do? Should I do a Ronald Reagan and just one day say, that's it, you've got 2 weeks, clean up the act, stop with the attitude, and just do your job and get those planes, I want 100% off the runway. And if they don't, what should I do?
Well, I think you've got part of that right. I think the first thing you do is you stop trying to fly planes that that only 26% of them take off. Because if I'm a customer, or if it's a military plane, if I'm in a war, if it can't get off the runway, it's no good.
Okay, so...
Stop. And then figure it out.
And then figure it out.
If you're the boss, you can't tell somebody else to figure it out. You've got to help figure it out. You've got to lead the charge to figure the problem out. And if you need help, then I'd go to somebody that really understood airplanes and get them to work with you.
Okay.
Because obviously your people can't solve the problem on their own. So you get somebody that's really expert in doing what you think the problem is.
Okay, but let's...
responsibility is yours.
Yeah, I know. But when it gets to the point where you've asked people and they don't deliver, this is... story, I'm relating this story to the Chicago Public Schools, because you're so connected to Chicago Public School, well, to Chicago. And I am so upset that more kids do not make it through school. So either they have to get their act together and hire the right consultants, because we can't have 26% of the kids being able to read. They are our future. And they are they it's just somebody better hire somebody to actually get these kids off the ground, because they're like the airplanes. They're stuck there. And only 26% can fly. So
I'll tell you what. I have fought very hard about this specific problem. We don't, unfortunately, have enough time today to discuss it, but I have fought very hard about this, and I think I have some solutions.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to invite you back, because as I said, I promised somebody else he could be on today, because he's eager to promote his book, and he's done a really great job with this book, and I don't want to keep him waiting too long. But what I want is I would like you to come back, and I would like actually specifically to talk about that kind of a thing, because you have this expertise, and I am trying to reach the right people, because for me, reading is the most important thing. If you can't read, now I can take any kid. I was a homeschool mom, and I can take any kid. You can give me any kid in America. Give me a kid, and I can teach. I can take a seven-year-old, and within 3 hours, 4 hours, I can teach them algebra. I guarantee it. You give me any kid, I can teach them. Give me a day, and by the end of the day, they will be able to give you the dates of all the major events in American history. I know how to do it, but I can't get through to the right people, and I want to encourage more people to think about it. So I want to invite you back, if you could come back in January, and we can talk about education, because in the end, it all comes down to education, and kids need to be able to read. I'm promoting books, but I need kids who can actually read the books.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I have actually, I'm writing another book right now, and that is a core topic within the book. So I would be delighted to.
Okay, so you're going to come back. I'll find some time for you so that we can actually talk about it, because I think your input can be very helpful. I have to let you go now. But I want, again, to tell people, I think this is a great book. It's a wonderful gift. All of you parents out there, I think you should get this book, because you will be inspired to start thinking about your own children's education. And it's called Commit and Deliver on the Front Lines of Management Consultant, because in the end, parents are the management consultants for their children.
Correct.
So, Cyrus Friedheim, I'm so really honored to have you on the program today. And as I said, now I'm like one degree of separation from Henry Kissinger. We didn't even get to talk about him, because he is my ultimate goal. Up that ladder of joy on paper, he's the one at the top that I want to talk to. Of all the people in the world.
I'll tell him.
You tell him. I want to talk to him. I've been trying to get through to his people the Queen of England isn't as important to me as I want to talk to him. He is the one person in the world that I really, really want to talk to. So I'm one degree, one step away, thanks to you, and thanks to your wonderful book. Now, do you have a website you want people to go to?
I don't have a website, but I think Amazon is the place to get it.
Everybody, go straight to that. Because we'll talk later about other things that, when you come back, we'll talk later about how you can reach out, really, to the homeschool associations, because they need to be inspired by your work. And again, everybody, it's called Commit and Deliver on the Front Lines of Management Consulting. Beautifully written, easy to read, with a lot of bullet points, a lot of really, explanations that really will hit the mark for you. So, again, thank you so much for being on the program today, Mr. Friedheim.
Well, thank you very much, Patsy.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to just put off the commercials for a few minutes because, as I said, I was really thrilled to be able to talk to Mr. Friedheim, but I am also thrilled to speak to Bobby Spears Jr. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. And I was really happy. Things are sort of crazy in this world, and it's not always easy for me. I have to try to think of what books I really want people to hear about and what books I think are important for them to try to understand some aspect of our life and about society. And so when I got your book, it's called Bedlam. The Life and Mind of Earl Sedgwick. And for me, you know, having lived in England and having been familiar with the real Bedlam, my first instinct was, oh my gosh, why would I want to read this book? I'm crazy enough, I don't know. But it turns out, first of all, it's a fascinating book. You've done a really great job with it. And it's a subject, because it touches on a subject that people are really concerned about today, the homeless, mm-hmm. and people who need help. So tell us about the book. What inspired you to write the book? And then we'll talk then a little bit about if you know or can think of any solutions for the problems.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. And your kind words, those are heartfelt, and I appreciate them. But Bedlam is a fictionalized memoir. It's about a second-generation mental health facility owner named Earl Sedgwick. And although he grew up hating this business for robbing him of his childhood, he finds himself as an adult, the owner of that very same business. And to complicate matters, he's an addict. And he's possibly schizophrenic himself and depressed from his own perceived lack of purpose. Now, specifically speaking, the residents of these mental health facilities are what I call the would-be homeless. And I think a lot of people don't understand that a lot of homelessness is not due to, like, you know, laziness or desire to be outside society or anything. This is a severe mental health crisis in our country. And that mental health crisis arises, I don't want to say specifically, but in my opinion, in the early 80s when the government defunded our state hospitals. At that time, suddenly we had a flooding in the streets of people who had severe mental health needs, and we really as a society didn't have the apparatus to handle it. And what inspired me to write the book is my own experiences. I've spent 20 years as I am an owner of a mental health facility. I spent 20 years providing care for these people. And I love these people. I love providing the care. I love my staff. What frustrated me was my perceived lack of support and partnership from the state governments that we would deal with. As a provider, I felt like we should be partners and in providing care. Instead, I felt like there's an adversarial relationship we have with the state government. Although obviously we need to regulate these buildings, we need to license these buildings. But at the end of the day, we're all supposed to be coming together to provide care for these people. And so that was what inspired me to write the book. The frustrations I was going through trying to provide this care, the frustration I was going through in dealing with some of the case management situations, some of the silly licensing I felt that was unnecessary, and the most important factor, the lack of financial support. You know, a lot of people see these buildings and these companies and assume that, you know, insurance must pay for it or there must be some huge stipend. Well, in Pennsylvania, for example, where I was working, you would be surprised to hear that the payment is like $40 a day to care for a human being. Now, I have a dog which I love, my buddy Lenny. When I go away on a trip with my family, we have to board Lenny. It's $50 a day to take care of Lenny. Now imagine you're getting paid $40 a day to take care of a human being, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So that was kind of a lot of the impetus for me writing this book.
Well, you're a very talented author because you really, do you take us into the story, let's say, really deeply into the story, sometimes disturbingly deep, but it's really, it's so well written, and as I said, when I first got the book, I thought, oh, I don't know, and then I got into it, and I thought, whoa, this is some fine writing.
So thank you. I want to say that every story that I relate in this book is absolutely true. Now, not all stories happen to the people I might said or to me personally, but it's really drawn from true life. And I think that, and I don't want to pat myself on the back that I'm a good writer. I appreciate you saying that. But I think what makes the stories come alive is that I'm a good listener. I pay attention, and the world around me really affects me, and I take it all in. And I just wanted to reflect that to people. And I guess my defense mechanism over the years that I've been doing that business has been my sense of humor. And so I've tried to bring that to the writing. I tried to make the stories not quite as sad as maybe they really are, you know. And some of it is heartbreaking. Some of it it will really tear you down. And the point of some of the book is that the main character, Earl, who's running this business, who's supposed to be the rock and provide this care, excuse me, it does affect him, you know, and it can't help but affect him. And honestly, hey, it affected me. Absolutely. You know, I know that the experiences that I had growing up in the business, running the business, dealing with the government, dealing with the residents and staff, it does absolutely affect you. So I tried to lighten it up a little bit by looking at it from a different angle. It's not all doom and gloom. Some of it is funny. You have to laugh at some of the stories that you hear and read in this book, and I had to experience in life.
Well, as I said, you know, one of the things, because right now, I mean, we see this every day on the news. Every day we see these tent cities that are growing all over the country, and it's really heartbreaking. I don't know what the solution is. I don't know if you know what the solution is. What can be done? Since you've seen it, you know, and understand the nature of the people who are out there and why they are out there, and what hope do you see for the future? How can we change things, really change things? Is it? It's not just throwing money at it, because a lot of the cities have thrown money at it, but they haven't accomplished much.
Well, I think that when we say you can't throw money at it, that is true in the simple sense of the phrase. However, money is a big part of it. We do need to allocate funds in our cities and our states to providing housing for these people. We do need to allocate funds in our cities and states to providing serious, intense mental health services for these people. Right now, we have a system that allows people to kind of float out there. And we don't. People who want to provide the care don't have the necessary tools to provide that care. You know, we can purchase armored tanks for our police forces to patrol our streets as if they're an occupying army. But we seem to make people, developers, for example, or care providers, jump through incredible hoops to build low-income housing or provide services for the people. So when you say, you know, we can't just throw money at it.
I mean, it has to be thoughtful. There has to be a thought process. Right. It's not just, you know, say, we need people who actually have not just the goal, but the right attitude of how to deal with it and how to wisely spend the money in the right areas, what do we need to do? How can we more focus on the right areas? And it seems so incomprehensible to me to see this homelessness. I just, it's frightening, and I get so frustrated not knowing and not hearing from any of our leaders how to solve the problem. I mean, it's right in their back doors. It's right, you know, in their streets of Washington, D.C. and San Francisco and all of these places where it's right there and nobody is really doing anything. It's growing.
I live in Los Angeles now. And when I moved here from Philadelphia, I was shocked riding through the streets of Los Angeles at the time, seeing the, like you said, the tent cities under the bridges, in front of people's houses, everywhere. And I thought the exact same thing. Like, what are we doing about this? Like, and we have two trains of thought, I believe, in our society. Not in my backyard, and it's their fault. And we can't view it that way. The government needs to decide that's going to build a real, true partnership with providers. It can't be, like you said, you can't just write a check and hand it to whoever has access to government and have them go run off and do what they want to do, because many times that's in a corrupt situation where you have somebody who just wants to line their pockets with money, right?
Exactly.
You have to have a partnership. You have to have a partnership with actual people who care. And the government has to be involved in it. And I don't mean just involved in let's license and regulate, like, you know, if there's a soil ceiling tile, we're going to write you a violation. I mean, let's have a partnership where we're discussing how we can best provide care on a daily, weekly, monthly basis for the people, so we're all working together. Because, listen, there are certain differences in providing care for people with mental health than there are providing care for other people. You know, for example, if you are a provider of personal care in Pennsylvania, there has to be some understanding from the government that the people you're providing care for are going to do some damage to their property. And the provider cannot be held to such a high standard of, like, if something's been broken while the inspector walks in the door, that they're going to lose their license. You know, it has to be a partnership. So it does push. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You know, it's so complicated. There's so many levels here. Now, are you involved in any of this work anymore, personally?
Yes. My family is still very heavily involved. We still own several buildings in Philadelphia. We have currently maybe 85 beds that we are still managing in Philadelphia. And we are still dealing with some of the same things. I mean, the state of Pennsylvania has gotten slightly better, but still we don't feel that, I don't feel that partnership that I'm hoping for. We are designing a coalition, a group of people in Pennsylvania, where we will be talking to the state government about this partnership that we're seeking. This is in the very beginning stages of it, so, you know, I can't really get into it right now, who's going to be involved. But, yeah, we're involved, and we believe that in order to solve this problem, it's really going to take a different view of the situation. You know, right now, government views itself as a way to regulate and punish, and that is hurting not only the providers, it's hurting the people that are trying to provide care for, because you're pushing people out who really care, because they can't do their job.
Well, I hope that people will get this book. As I said, it's very well written. You have a natural talent for writing. And because we have to start thinking about it. I worry so much about them. Now it's wintertime. It's cold out there. It breaks my heart. It really breaks my heart to think of what they're suffering. And it's not right. And it's not, there has to be somebody, and perhaps it's going to be you. It will have to be, I don't know how to get through to these people anymore. I don't know how to get through to the politicians. I don't know how to get through to these people. Wake up and solve these problems, because it's just too heartbreaking. And you certainly write about it in your book. And I'm so happy that, you know, you wrote this book. And I'm so happy that I got the book and that I can help you perhaps get out there. People, you know, get the book. You might at first say, well, I don't think I'm going to like the book, because it's a little bit scary. I'm going to tell you, people, you look at it and you just the idea. By the way, people, Bedlam comes from the name of a hospital in England. And of course, I lived in England for a long time. And it comes from actually the Bethlehem Royal Hospital was nicknamed Bedlam. So just understand where it comes from. But you've done a great job. Did you have a website or social media you want people to look at?
No, I don't have a website. I can be found on social media at Bobby, FIGGAZ. But the book is available on Random Penguin House.
Yeah.
House Penguin. And it's available, obviously, on Amazon.
Yeah.
Like everybody.
Yeah.
It's I really, really appreciate it.
Yeah. People, give this book a chance. Your initial reaction might be, oh, I don't know if I can take it. But you can. You can. And the stories, as Bobby says, he put in enough humor there so that, you know, we read the story. And I really want to compliment you on that. And I hope that, you can perhaps expand on some of the stories. Who knows? You might get an offer from Hollywood, and they'll do a movie about you, because I think the work that you're doing, your family's trying, but you're just a small little speck in the ocean of this big problem. And but I really do appreciate what you've done with this book.
Well, thank you so very much.
Okay, and it's called Bedlam, The Life and Mind of Earl Sedgwick. And it's a fascinating book. And again, thank you, Bobby Spears Jr., for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you so very much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Okay, take care now. And I know you'll keep helping people, especially during the cold winter that's coming up.
Absolutely. We certainly will.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye now. Well, you know, I'm getting sick and tired of all this. We don't have in our area that many. We don't see them around too much. But, you know, and it's warmer here. Right now, you know, it's 80 degrees in Florida. So, you know, but this isn't right. This is America. There's no excuse. There absolutely is no excuse for a tent city. No excuse. Not any city in America has an excuse to have a tent city. No excuse. You have to talk to people, and all of us have to say, this is enough. This is just enough. And there are ways to solve the problem, and it has to be smart, and it has to be in conjunction with a lot of different things, certainly perhaps with faith and all sorts of different mediums that we can embrace. But there's no excuse, and I don't have time anymore. This has been an exciting day. Two wonderful authors. Oh, my goodness. I have to leave to finish. Okay, everybody. Remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. And your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry, because I want to see Witch City Mysteries, but I also want to see her new series based right here in our area. Oh my goodness, it's going to be so much fun. Haunted Haven. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed, for everything. He saluted me, and I saluted him because I would have made a great general. I've been so good. Oh, it just thrills me when I think about it. Oh, and Jack Reacher is coming out on February 4th. My goodness, I can't wait. Streaming video, Jack Reacher. Finally, everybody, the new guy is gorgeous. Oh, my God, what a hunk. What a hunk Jack Reacher turned out to be. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Take care. Bye-bye.